Shrink Wrap Radio number 403, Insights on Rape, Courage, and Authenticity, from the cartooning psychologist, Dr. Nina Burrows.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Dr. Nina Burrows, who is not only a forensic psychologist specializing in rape and sexual abuse, but also an author who is using cartooning to deal with psychologically difficult topics. For more information about Dr. Burrows, go to our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Nina Burrows, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much.
Well, it's great to have you here, especially since when you reached out to me expressing interest in possibly being interviewed, and you let me know that you're a listener. And listeners always get priority.
I've been listening to Shrink Wrap Radio for years now. So, yeah, this is doubly exciting for me.
Oh, that's good. That's good. And it's not every day that I get to interview a cartooning psychologist.
I think I might be the only one. So, yeah, I hope you enjoy today.
By the way, are you in the London area or where are you based?
Yeah, I'm central London, so I can literally hear Big Ben from my bedroom. So that's how central I am.
Oh, that's wonderful. I've had a chance to visit London two or three times and always really enjoy it.
So. I'm deeply in love with this city. It's a fantastic place to live.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Well, I mentioned your cartooning, but before we get into the cartooning aspect of your career, I'd like to spend some time talking with you about your work in forensic psychology.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, perhaps you can define for our audience just what is meant by the term forensic psychology.
So forensic psychology is looking at the psychology around criminal behavior. And certainly, in terms of my experience with it, a lot of the work in terms of if you're employed as a forensic psychologist is mostly working with people who have been caught for their offense and have been convicted, and they're spending time serving whatever sentence. And your job is to work with them so that they don't reoffend when they are back in the community. So when I meet people and say, oh, yeah, I work in forensic psychology, they normally think I help the police catch criminals. But I can assure you that my job doesn't involve any running or chasing or any kind of crime fighting in that respect.
Okay. So how did a nice, sweet young lady such as yourself first become interested in the field of forensic psychology?
You're making huge assumptions about me there, Dave. I'm fascinated with people, definitely, and I really, really enjoyed doing my degree in psychology. And at the end of it, I was they had a competition to for a bursary for a PhD, and it was suggested to me that I might like to apply for it. And I had to choose at the time between being supervised by someone who was an expert in forensic psychology, so therefore that's what my PhD would be in, and the other alternative was to do something on primates. And so I had this mad 2 weeks where I was trying to decide which way I wanted my future to go, but in all honesty, it was actually quite easy to choose the forensic psychology because I've always been interested in people, and I've always been interested in the kind of clinical aspects of psychology, the practice of psychology. And this felt like a really great way to be a researcher, but also still very much have a foot in that practitioner space.
Uh-huh. Okay, that's interesting. And within that specialization, it appears that you further specialized in rape and sexual abuse. How did that come about?
That was my first job. So I was writing up my PhD, and my PhD was on criminal behavior and rehabilitation, but it was kind of generic. It wasn't about a specific offense type. But then I landed myself a job at the headquarters of the prison service, and that job was with the sex offender team. So that's when I started looking at that particular offense type, and I found the work really fascinating. I mean, so challenging as a psychologist to understand that aspect of human behavior is very, very challenging. And therefore, I just found it really interesting. And having worked with offenders with the prison service, I made a conscious choice to broaden my horizons. And so I began volunteering with charities that support survivors of abuse so that I could make sure that I could see the issue from both perspectives.
Oh, that's interesting.
And, yeah.
And working, being attached to the prison service, that sounds depressing. Has it been depressing for you?
No, I love that job. Prisons actually, people often ask me, did you feel unsafe or all these things? I always felt exceptionally safe. And I met some fascinating people, really interesting people. I mean, obviously, I spent a lot of time both with staff and with people who are serving their sentence. And I always felt safe, and I didn't find it a depressing space. But of course, I mean, I got to go home at the end of the day.
Yeah, that's an important difference. Is it strictly a women's prison that you're involved with?
No, so at the time I was working for the headquarters of the prison service, so they would send me all around the prison estate, so I would get to go to lots of places, and because the vast majority of the prison population are male, and certainly the sex offenders are, you know, very much so, predominantly male, I was sent to the specific prisons that were housing sex offenders.
Uh-huh. On your website, you have a link to a report that you've written for prosecutors regarding myths about rape. And
yeah.
you list 10 such myths in the report. And maybe I should have warned you ahead of time. I don't know if you've got the report anywhere nearby, but I was hoping maybe you could take us through those 10 myths.
I'm not going to remember all 10 of them for sure, but certainly in terms of rape myths, I think the thing about rape and sexual abuse is it's a topic that people find intimidating and scary. And the obvious thing to do when something's like that is to not think about it or to think that it's got nothing to do with you or dismiss it. And so it's an area that is rich in myths and stereotypes. And I think for me, the biggest and probably most dangerous myth is the one we have about the actual sex offenders, that they're these monsters that hang around in dark alleyways at night or hang around in children's playgrounds. And so when we hear about an offense and it doesn't involve a dark alleyway and it's not a stranger and it isn't some dangerous criminal attacking a member of the public, people get really confused when they hear a story that is described, you know, this is a rape case, but actually the two people knew each other and they liked each other and they were having a good evening. But now one of them is accusing the other of rape. And so a lot of our myths come from our confusion that it doesn't fit what we're expecting to hear. And so many of the myths are things like, A real victim of rape will try to fight or flee, that they will report the offence to the police immediately, that if they were drinking or in any way wearing provocative clothing, then it wasn't rape. These kinds of things that we try and force the information that we hear to fit our stereotype of what we think rape is. But unfortunately, that stereotype is very inaccurate.
Yes, and I'm just now searching for your report, actually, so I could ask you about some of the other myths. I'm trying to remember what they were.
The really interesting thing about that report, the thing that I found fascinating, was that we know that these myths that we have about victims are very prevalent, and there's lots of research about them. And they're a problem in court because the prosecutor is trying to communicate to a jury, and the jury probably have lots of these myths and stereotypes going around in their head. And so one of the main points I was trying to make in my report is that we need to start telling more accurate stories about the offender to help people understand that actually if you're an offender who wants to get away with their offense, or an offender who actually isn't able to recognize that that's what they're doing, then the kind of offense you're most likely to commit is actually the what we call acquaintance rape, which is when the two people, the defendant and the complainant, know each other.
Yeah, I think here often that's called date rape.
Yeah, because
it often happens in that context. And I've found the list of myths, and that, in fact, speaks to the first one, is the myth that rape occurs between strangers in dark alleys. Mm-hmm. And you say the majority of rapes, 66% of them, are committed by persons known to the victim.
And yeah, victims absolutely.
Are often raped in their homes.
Mm-hmm. And if you're a perpetrator of that offense, having ready access to a victim is obviously a lot easier than going out there and attacking a stranger. You just have to look at your own behavior. If some stranger approaches you in a public space and starts a conversation, especially if that's a bar or something like that, you can be on alert. Your defenses can be up. But if it's a friend of a friend, someone you know, then you immediately you feel relaxed and you feel safe. And that's often how victims feel before the offense.
And a lot of people have the idea of this next one that you've listed here, that women provoke rape by the way that they dress or act.
I think because we're trying to understand what happened, we're putting all of this attention and focus on what the defendant did and didn't do. But if you were to compare that to other crimes, say if someone stole my car, you wouldn't be looking at my behavior before that offense took place. It would be quite a straightforward thing to understand. You blame the offender for the offense, not the victim. But when it comes to rape, because I think we find it so confusing, we focus so much on the victim and what they did and didn't do. And we don't really even have that conversation about the defendant and what they did and didn't do.
Yeah. Also, another myth that you debunk is that rape is a crime of passion. If it's not a crime of passion, what is it?
I think lots of people, because they're trying to understand sexual violence, and if it's not something that they have an academic or professional knowledge of, they use some framework that they do have a knowledge of. And for many people, the most obvious framework to use or schema it is about normal dating relationships and normal sex. I think that's why people use that lens to try and understand sexual violence. But the motivations of the offender when they're committing a sex offense, it's got nothing to do with intimacy and love or connection. And especially in the case of rape. In the case of rape, the victim is either actively trying to fight off the offender, although in most cases they're not. In most cases they've frozen. So where they've frozen, they are completely non-responsive, not at all responsive. And consent in intimacy is actively given. So if someone is saying, well, she didn't say no, that's not, she didn't say no isn't consent. And I think the other thing that's really important to help people understand is the reason why that victim is frozen is because they're terrified. And we are absolutely hardwired to detect fear in one another. I would need to know if you're afraid, because the thing that you're frightened of might be a threat to me. So when someone's committing an offense, they're detecting that fear on some level, but they're carrying on with what they're doing. And it could well be that the fear is exactly what they're looking for, or it's just that the fear isn't enough to make them stop. But the scenario I've just described there, that's so far removed from normal, healthy intimacy. It has nothing to do with connection and everything to do with violence and control.
Yes, yes. And, so you spoke to the next one, which is if she didn't scream, fight, or get injured, it wasn't rape. But as you say, it's very likely that the person will go into a frozen response. What do you advise women to resist if they find themselves in that situation? Do you advise them to try to fight?
I think the thing to know with the frozen response is it isn't a choice. This is your automatic system taking over your fight or flight response. I think we'd all like to, because we're frightened of rape and sexual abuse, we like to think that if we were attacked, we would talk ourselves out of it, or we would run away, or we'd fight, and that would be successful. And that's a clever thing for us to do. It makes us feel safe. but it's not true. We're actually very likely to freeze, and that freeze then goes into a relaxed flop. And that's our instinctive brain looking after us. I mean, as a human being, I mean, we don't have many natural predators now, but the natural predators that we have, like, we can't outrun them and we can't outfight them. So the freeze response as a human being is a smart response that our instinctive brains have learned over generations. And that is actually what's most likely to happen.
I'm thinking, though, of women who have taken self-defense classes, maybe. You know, there are groups out there that advocate that women really stand up for themselves and maybe even do so physically. But I guess if they do that, I mean, depending upon who the rapist is and et cetera, they might be risking their life.
So, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You don't know how far it's going to go. And I think also with those classes, you have to be very careful to not add to the victim blaming narrative. I think those classes work if you can train your instinctive brain so that your instinct is to fight. But that would take an awful lot of training. I mean, rape and sexual abuse is something that happens to people who are trained in the military, so that they've had a high degree of armed combat training, and yet they still freeze too.
Oh, so, wow, that's an interesting point.
Yeah. Yeah, you're trying to override something that's very powerful, and as you said earlier, something that you don't know if that rape was going to turn into something else, and at the time that's certainly this is a survival thing. You don't know that you're going to survive.
It's always been difficult for women to report rape because they are concerned that they're going to be accused of of either having provoked it somehow, or that they're doing it because they want revenge on the person for some reason. But you've kind of studied that statistically.
Absolutely. I think, and that's a very common myth that many people report rape and it's not really rape. Again, that's because our expectations have been confounded, and we're trying to make sense of why would someone do that. But I mean, the realities of reporting a rape, this is not an easy process for anyone to go through. I mean, it can be exceptionally difficult. But the offenders can be very manipulative afterwards and try to convince the victim that what happened wasn't rape and wasn't an offence. I mean, if you remember that most perpetrators are known to their victim. And I think also people who've experienced abuse, they also live in the same society as us. They were thinking that they were going to fight. They were thinking that they were going to be able to run away. They were never expecting to be attacked by someone they trusted. So they have all of these internal doubts in their own mind too. So all of this can come together to make it very difficult for them to report the offence. This is before you even think about if that perpetrator is a known person, maybe a family member, what is the impact on the family, and so on and so forth. So very, very difficult for people to report the offence. And the estimates you read a lot in the research is that only 1 in 10 offences get reported, and that figure would probably be lower for male victims.
And some other statistics that you report here is, you say data from 2,643 cases suggests that the level of false reporting is somewhere between 8% and 0.2%.
Yes. It's one of those things that it really depends how you count the numbers. Sometimes people look at whether the case was dropped. Well, the case can be dropped for so very many reasons other than a known to be false allegation. Many women can retract what they've said, but they can do that out of fear of the perpetrator rather than the fact that it was a false report in the first place. So it's a particularly difficult statistic to pin down. But when you ask the public how many, what percentage of reports of rape do you think are false? They give you figures like 40%, something like this. So they think a significant minority are false accusations. Mm-hmm. The reality is, you know, is very low indeed.
Yes. Another myth that you cite here is that male rape is an offense that takes place between gay men.
Yeah. I think that's how people understand, again, that information when they receive it. But it's, again, not true. It's hard to get statistics for this whole space because, of course, most offences aren't reported. But of what we know is it's very much a heterosexual offence. This is heterosexual men raping heterosexual men. It isn't exclusive to the gay community at all.
Right, and another one here is prostitutes cannot be raped.
Yeah, if someone is working as a sex worker, they still making a choice about what it is that they're selling and what it is that they're agreeing to. And the minute what happens goes against that choice, then that is rape. Rape is about consent.
And one you don't even mention here, but that sort of fits with what you're saying now is, even within a marital context, it can be rape, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, absolutely. Marriage, I mean, it's crazy. It was only relatively recently that the law was changed here in England. But, up until the early 90s, I think it was. Absolutely, you can rape within a marriage.
Okay. And the final one, which I think you've covered, is if the victim didn't complain immediately, then it wasn't rape. But you cite a statistic here that the vast majority, estimated at 90% of victims, never report the rape to the police.
Yeah, yes. So those that do are the exceptional few, and it can take many of them a very long time to do that. The people who tend to report straight away are people who experience, if you like, the stereotypical rape, which was actually the minority rape. So stranger rapes do tend to be reported more swiftly because it fits within people's stereotypes. But yeah, as you can see, the whole space is so very, very rich in psychology. And I've had, I've really enjoyed looking at it from the perspective of the offender, the victim, also for this report, the prosecutor, and more importantly for this report, the public. And as a psychologist, it's an amazing space to try and get your head around.
Yes. Do you find that these myths perhaps unconsciously have an impact on judges and juries and prosecutors? Because they're people too, and
rape myths are alive and well, unfortunately, in every courtroom. The myth really comes from a lack of understanding and knowledge. And because we don't talk about sexual abuse in society, it's in the press all the time, but we don't have a conversation about it. That those myths will just continue to be there until people have a more informed understanding of the realities of sexual abuse.
What sort of evidence is there that jury decision-making is affected by these kinds of myths?
So in my report, I look at the studies that have been done looking at the impact of rape myths on decision-making. It's very difficult to do research with actual juries. So most of those studies are done with members of the public. And a typical study would give them some information about a case, some sort of scenario, and then they would ask them what verdict they would give, or they would ask them to rate how believable they felt the defendant or complainant was. And those studies show that the myths definitely do have an impact on the decisions that people make. And when you're in a situation where just a few members of the jury can swing a decision, that, you know, even if it's just a minority of jurors, that can end up having a huge impact on the whole space, which is why, and it was doing that project, up until that point, all the work that I had done in the sexual violence space had been written for my fellow psychologists or government policymakers or practitioners. Mm-hmm. And it was creating this report that made me start to think, you know what, I really need to start producing some content for the public, which is what prompted the cartooning and prompted the recent book. And so writing that report has definitely been a huge catalyst for me, and it's definitely driven by a desire to help people understand this area better.
Yeah. Now, in your report, you talk about the need to develop alternative narratives in relation to rape. But I'm not quite sure what you're getting at there, and developing alternative narratives for whom?
So the point I'm making there is that when we talk about these rape myths and we talk about rape, we're invariably talking about the victim. And we simply don't have that conversation about the defendant, the offender, unless that we're talking about the monster in the alleyway. And so we need to start having conversations about the realities of the sex offender. I think this is why when somebody who's a celebrity who is loved and admired is then accused of committing a sex offense, there can be huge uproar because that individual doesn't fit our stereotype in any way, shape, or form. And I think that's for me, an indicator that we need to start helping people understand, and this is a very difficult thing to do, but help them understand that sex offenders look like normal, everyday individuals. They do not look like the monster image that you have in your head, which is a very difficult message for people to hear.
Yeah, we've had some high-profile cases in this country where, I believe, athletes, sports figures, famous ones, have been accused of rape.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you mentioned something you call hindsight bias. What are you getting at there?
This is how the hindsight bias is what's happening when a juror is listening to the evidence and they are judging normally the victim's behavior, but they're judging them with the benefit of hindsight. So they're not remembering that at the time that individual didn't know that they were about to get raped, or they didn't know during the offense whether they were going to survive the whole thing. And so with the benefit of hindsight, they are blaming them for what happened, mm-hmm. but they're failing to recognize that actually, there were probably tens of thousands of women who on the very same evening made very, very similar choices to go out, to dress nicely, to drink alcohol, and they didn't, those other women didn't get raped. The reason why this woman did is because she happened to be with a rapist. But instead of recognizing that with hindsight, the juror can be blaming them for every choice that they made.
You also have a section on the rape offenders themselves, and you raise some interesting questions, one of which is, how do you differentiate a rapist from a non-rapist? Well, what's the answer to that question?
in terms of looking at them, you don't. Do you mean in terms of the law or?
I wasn't sure. I just pulled that out of your report. I saw you had a heading called differentiate. So maybe that you can't tell by looking really was the point, that that's one of the myths.
Oh, absolutely. The idea that you could spot somebody in a lineup. Absolutely not. I mean, as part of my job, I used to tour the prison estate quite a lot and go into lots of prisons, and you wouldn't have to be told. You would know when you were on the wing which housed majority sex offenders, because it would be on that wing that you would see every section of society represented in terms of age and ethnicity and class and educational background. The other wings tended to be predominantly young men. Mm-hmm. I can assure you that, pick any man off the street, sadly, that's what sex offenders look like. They look like everybody.
Are there any generalizations we can make in terms of the psychology of rapists, of why they offend?
In the report, I introduce, if you like, four types of offender. I mean, I use stereotypes in there. The reality, of course, is any one offender could be a blend of the four.
Sure.
And I think certainly and we tend to think of the violent, sadistic offender, and yes, that type of offender does exist. There's also the offender who uses their offending as a coping mechanism. So for whatever reason, they have developed this way of coping, that perhaps they require sex to cope, but they feel unable to get sex, so they take non-consensual sex. Or they may have specifically developed a way of coping that is non-consensual sex. They actually need to rape in order to cope, so that there's that kind of perpetrator. There's also the perpetrator whose offending is motivated by their attitudes towards women. So they have an attitude that they're just entitled to sex from women whenever they wish, and that when a woman says no, she really means yes, and all of the rest of it. So their offending would be driven by their attitudes to women. And then the fourth group, which is a group that I think I encounter a lot in the kind of acquaintance rape kind of scenarios, is the offender who is offending, but their level of self-denial is so high, they're actually able to kid themselves that they're not offending. I think it's important to recognize that sex offenders like to think of themselves in a positive light, just like everybody else. We all like to excuse and dismiss ourselves of our wrongs, and they're the same as we are in that respect. And to admit to yourself that you've committed a sex offense is actually a very difficult thing to do. It's a massive threat. It could potentially be a massive threat to your self-concept. Mm-hmm. So offenders are highly motivated to deny or dismiss their own behavior. So this type of offender is talking themselves both into the offense and out of the offense, but they're managing to do it with such levels of denial that when they're finally accused of rape, they're absolutely shocked. But this is the amount of work that they've been doing to delude themselves.
Yeah, maybe that leads into something else that you write about, which is the offender responses after the offense. So mm-hmm. is that sort of the denial, I guess, kind of gets into that. What are the, you know, we have this image of sex offenders that sex offenders can't change, you know, that it's so deep in their personality. Is that true of rapists in general? What's the prospect for therapy or other kinds of rehabilitation?
Well, actually, in terms of rehabilitating an offender, the statistics on how successfully can you rehabilitate a sex offender are good. Your offender who is a career criminal in terms of theft or something like that is actually, you know, that it's quite hard to rehabilitate that person. They're quite likely to reoffend. The reoffending rates for short-term offenders is massively high. Sex offenders, it's actually quite low. So for the minority who are caught and convicted, when they are released into the community, actually the reoffending rates or reconviction rates are low. So the rehabilitation efforts. I also think just the process of being caught and convicted and serving what was probably a long sentence. So yes, whilst there might be a myth there, for the ones that are caught, the data tells us that actually rehabilitation can happen.
Uh-huh. Now, do you appear as an expert witness in court?
No, I don't. No. We actually, over here with our system, we don't currently have people with my kind of knowledge as expert witnesses. So you'd have somebody as an expert talking about the specific individuals in the case, but you wouldn't have someone come in and talking about rape myths in general or sexual offending in general.
Okay, so what are the challenges that you face as a forensic psychologist? Because, you know, there are listeners out there who are students and who are maybe at a choice point, kind of like you were not so long ago, you know, which direction do I want to go within psychology? What are the challenges of being a forensic psychologist?
I think my cartooning was born out of one of the main challenges, which is how do you spend an awful lot of your time thinking about rape and sexual abuse and stay healthy. And there's lots of things you can do. I mean, I have supervision and all of these things. But I actually started cartooning as a way of self-care. I think it's not realistic to think that this doesn't affect you. In fact, that I think the minute my work doesn't affect me is probably the minute I should stop doing it. So it's a case of recognizing, no, there will be an impact of doing this. And what are you doing to mitigate or deal with or cope with that impact? So my first piece of advice, obviously, would be to start cartooning immediately.
We're going to get into the cartooning in just a moment. What about the flip side? What are the rewards in the work that you do?
For me, what I do is so deeply challenging as a psychologist. I wonder, would there be a better space for me to learn my craft? Because the psychology is so rich and difficult and interesting, not just to understand what's happening, but also in terms of communicating to other people about it. I think it's given me the kind of challenge that has then sort of fed into all of my other work. So definitely, I don't think you certainly won't be bored. No way.
Yeah. Now, is part of what you do? Do you do therapy with offenders or not?
No, so I'm purely a researcher. So I have I trained as a counselor, but I made that choice simply because I thought I'd be a better researcher if I went through that training. Because I'm a qualitative researcher primarily, so most of my work is in-depth interviews. So yeah, that's why I did it. But I don't see clients.
Okay, so you've been chomping at the bit here to talk about the cartooning, and that's definitely one of the really interesting things about you and what you're doing. So let's talk now about your morphing into the cartooning psychologist.
Yes, morphing is a good way to describe it.
Yeah. So in part, you say that it had to do with self-care.
Yeah, learning to draw was the self-care, definitely. When I started drawing, I had no intention of turning that drawing into anything other than a way to relax. I always had drawn badly. I think I'm quite a visual learner. And when I was training, doing my counseling training, and as part of that, you would have to do a certain number of hours with clients in terms of practice. And when I had to write up my notes from the sessions, my notes were always cartoons. They were very badly drawn matchstick men. But there was something about communicating that experience in cartoons that made sense to me. It's just that I lacked the skills to draw it well. So I think in some ways it's always been there. But I've always had this idea that, I can't draw.
And on your website, you show some examples of a drawing that you did before you sort of really applied yourself to studying drawing.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't a matchstick person, and it was a self-portrait.
Yeah.
It was really good, I thought.
When I sat down to do that, I was surprised how well that came out. I really like how well I can draw now, I think I always had an eye, but not the skill, or maybe it was just the confidence. But what I really loved about my process of learning to draw is, like, of course, you just need to sit down and practice and learn. Like, anybody can draw. You need to choose to become that person. You need to choose to learn the skill. Just in the same way that no one sits down and can play the piano just like that, you have to learn your scales and you have to go through the process. Drawing is just the same.
Yeah. Now, at first blush, it might seem that cartooning would be far afield from your forensic work, but actually you've used your newly acquired skills to illustrate two books that you've written, one titled The Little Book of Authenticity, and the other is titled The Courage to Be Me. So tell us about these books and what your cartooning ability adds to those books.
So the Courage to Be Me is, what I've done with that book is I've taken a research report, and the research report was a project I did where I was interviewing women who had been raped or sexually abused, and I was interviewing them about their experiences of group therapy. And having done that research and been moved by the courage of these women during the interviews and really massively inspired by them, it felt like such a shame to take all of that beautiful data and just leave it in a research report, because I think a research report does many things. It's a great way to communicate to your fellow academics and to practitioners, but it's always felt to me such a shame that the individuals who could most benefit from our knowledge can't access that material, so the people who are living this life. So having done that study and watched these women, and there was one participant in particular who'd really struggled during the interview, but struggled in a very determined way. Like, there was no way she wanted to stop. She wanted to carry on, but it was hard for her to carry on. And at the end of the interview, I reflected back to her. It's like, that looked like it was quite hard for you to share that story with me. Can I ask you why you chose to come in today and talk to me? And she told me that if one person could benefit from the research I was doing, then what she'd been through would be worth it. And that really stayed with me. And I heard that a lot. And I thought about the research report, and I thought about what I've heard and the stories, and I think, you know, I think we can do better than that. So I made the choice to turn the research report into a graphic novel. And that graphic novel is now free on the internet. And my hope with that is that many other people who have experienced rape or sexual abuse, who are out there and they're on the internet and they're looking for resources, I really hope they find this book, because the book tells that story of having this experience and finding the courage to rebuild your life afterwards.
Well, I didn't realize that it was available free on the internet. So is that from your site?
Yeah, it's on my website. I was really determined that the people who needed it the most would be able to access it. And some people can't afford to buy a book. Some people are still living in abusive relationships, so they would be very afraid to have a book about abuse in the home. Some people are too young to buy a book like this. And some people, and I think this is probably a lot of people, they're simply just not ready to walk into a bookshop and buy a book about sexual abuse. So the whole book is on my website, and I'm getting some amazing feedback from the people who have found it, and it's obviously been, for them, the right resource at the right time.
Oh, that's got to be very gratifying to you.
It is. It makes me all the more determined to get it out there so that more people can find that, because as far as I'm concerned, this is actually the largest group of people who've experienced sexual abuse. We know that they don't report the offence to the police, but I think they're also not accessing support services. They're perhaps not told anybody about their experience. So this is a big, big group of people that are living with this in isolation. And we know all about the psychology of why they're living with it in isolation. It's because we don't talk about it in society. It's because they're probably living with shame and guilt, fear that they're beyond help. And also a sense that, well, that this happened maybe 10, 15, 20 years ago. Why bring that up now? So there are many, many reasons why people may be reluctant to come forward for help. And those are the very reasons that the book addresses.
Yeah. Now, I'll be giving the URL for your website at the end of the review, so our interview, so you don't have to worry about doing that now. I'm wondering, though, have you thought about also making the books available through, say, Amazon.com to reach an even wider audience?
Yeah, so when I originally started this project of creating this book, I was just intending to put it for free on my website. But then lots of people asked me, oh, but, you know, are you going to print it? Could we have the paperback? And I was like, oh, I don't know. Like, I've only just learned how to draw. I don't know if I can create an illustrated book and print it and everything. But the requests became greater and greater. So now it is available on Amazon, and as an ebook. So you can get your hands on a paperback version of it And the wonderful things about self-publishing these days is that it's available, you know, internationally straight away. So yeah, it was there. And I've been getting lots of individual counselors, but also organizations get in contact with me because they see this as a fantastic resource to give to people who are maybe on a waiting list. So some support whilst they're waiting for therapy, or they're not specialist organization for sexual abuse. So maybe they are a drug or alcohol rehabilitation organization, a kind of place where actually there's lots of people disclosing a history of sexual abuse, but they don't feel like they have the in-house expertise to deal with that. So that they're using the book as a resource to help people take the next step, which is to get the specialist support that they need.
Yeah, that's such a great idea to have professionals making it available to clients in various settings. I must say, from the pieces that I was able to see on your website, and I didn't realize I could look at a whole book, but the cartooning is very charming and engaging, and I think it helps to, I don't know if this is the right word, but to detoxify the experience somewhat by putting it in a lighter kind of context.
Yes, cartooning is such a human medium. It's very compassionate, and it's very gentle. I like that the reader kind of sees what they're able to see. Like you can read a graphic novel six times, and on the sixth time you'll see something you haven't noticed on the other five occasions. And I think there's something very gentle about it. And the feedback I'm getting from people is that getting feedback from people who are often triggered. So this means that if they read anything about rape or sexual abuse, it actually triggers within them like a trauma response, because they find it all so very overwhelming. The feedback I'm getting is that people aren't getting triggered by this book because it's handling exactly the same material. I have a whole chapter on trauma and guilt and shame. The book really does cover the material, but it does it in such a gentle and compassionate way that people are able to emotionally connect with it and engage with it and of course understand it. I think it's been a real challenge. I think some people think cartooning is dumbing down, and it really isn't. To me, it's distilling. It's been a massive challenge to distill that information into, you know, a lot. Normally, if I write something, it's thousands and thousands and thousands of words long. This is only a few hundred words long. You really have to get to the main point and make it clearly and then move on. So I'm enjoying the intellectual challenge as well.
Yeah, one thing that comes to mind just now is the graphic novel Mouse, which I think deals with the Holocaust. And are you familiar with that?
I think that's Chris Ware, I think, is the illustrator there, or the author of that book. I haven't read that one, but I'm a big fan of his work. And I think cartoons are a really, really great way of tackling anything that's difficult, either difficult intellectually or difficult emotionally. And with rape and sexual abuse, you've got both of them there. And I think what was just an observation for me is, as a researcher, I mean, research reports are great in that they perform a very important function, but you don't capture a large audience with a research report. And I mean, I don't tend to read them time and time again, but my cartoons, I read them tens and tens of times because it's fun and it's quick and you see something different every time. And so as a medium, it really is a great way to genuinely communicate.
Did you go out and study other graphic novels to, you know, for inspiration?
No, I didn't. I worked with a team of illustrators. So the book is six chapters long. I've illustrated two of them, and then we have another four illustrators, and they're massively talented. And actually, one of my favorite things about the book is that every chapter feels different because you have a different person drawing it. Huh. So I've let them bring their own style to their chapters, and because I'm a beginner, my chapters has a style which is, hi, I'm a beginner. So my chapters are different, but they're certainly good enough to get the point across.
Now, what's the difference between the two books? You've got one on authenticity and the others on courage. Are they targeted to different either topic areas or different audience?
The way my work works for me is I divide my work into two. One half is the forensic psychology. So all of that content, which is the courage to be me, all of that content now I'm very much aiming at the public. So the courage to be me is my first piece of material for the public, trying to help people understand sexual abuse. So that's one half of my output, if you like. The other half is what I do to, initially it's what I started to do to unwind and relax, to allow myself to think about psychology, but not specifically not about rape and sexual abuse. And what I'm doing with that other half is I am trying to do the most interesting thing I can think of doing as a psychologist, which is to really look at that question, well, what does it mean to be a human being? And that's a very long-term project for me. The little book on authenticity is the first of many, many books, which is me going through a slow process of illustrating what I find to be the most fascinating psychology I can think of.
Oh, that's really exciting. Yeah, I was going to ask you where you see yourself going in the future, but I think you've just spoken to that. Well, as we wind down, is there anything more that you'd like our listeners to know?
I think one of the things I'm really enjoying about my work is I'm completely independent, and there's something that I think is really that I'm really valuing about that in terms of being a psychologist. Today's actually been a real treat for me because I very, very rarely speak to a fellow psychologist. I'm going out of my way to talk to members of the public or people of different professions. And I think there's something interesting about what happens in our profession when somebody gives themselves that freedom. And I think in terms of innovation and creativity, I've been really, really enjoying what happens when I give myself permission to take my profession and my work and my career in any direction I choose. And I'm just finding the whole process so rich and rewarding that I hope that it's of interest to my fellow psychologist. But I also think there's something about the person who's working out on the margins of any profession that they're able to see things that other people can't see because they're not out on the margins. And also I'm in a position where I can choose to try things that it would be very difficult to perhaps do if you had a boss. So I just imagining the scenario where you say to your boss, yeah, that research report, I'm going to turn it into a graphic novel. But as someone who works for themselves, I can make that choice. And so yeah, I'm very much enjoying that. And I hope that I have quite a few people who are psychologists following me on my website. And I think they're enjoying seeing what she's doing next. And I hope it helps. I hope it feeds into their work too.
Well, keep me posted on what you're doing next. And I'm struck by the titles of your books are also really about you, you know, the book of authenticity and a book titled The Courage to Be Me.
Yeah.
And that's sort of what you're putting into action, because I would imagine that you'd have a voice in your head, much as the voice that I had in my head when I started to do this podcast, was sort of, well, what are other psychologists going to think about this, you know? And you know, maybe they'll be really critical.
Yeah, of course. There's on my website, there's a link to a talk I do, which is on courage and vulnerability. And if you watch that talk, you'll see that those voices are very much alive and well in my head. But that's okay. That's all just part of being human. I think that's a big part of my message is that I think being human isn't something you try to avoid, fix, or control. It's something to understand. And certainly with my work, everything that I'm working on the moment has a central theme. And I feel that what I'm doing at the moment is exploring the psychology of one person who's in a room on their own. And that's my big project for now. I think it'd take me at least another 4 or 5 years to produce all the content that I'd like to do just around that, just one person on their own. So things like authenticity and courage and choice and self-compassion and all of these things. very excited about what will be the next project, which is the psychology that happens when someone else walks in that room. So it's going to be a long ride, but it's going to be a lot of fun too.
Well, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. Dr. Nina Burrows, thanks for being a Shrink Wrap Radio listener, and thanks for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you ever so much, Dave.
It's great to have had the opportunity of interviewing another one of my listeners who's also a professional psychologist. It's always particularly gratifying to me to discover such accomplished fellow professionals in our listening audience. I'm impressed by the intelligence and empathy that Dr. Burrows brings to her work with both the victims of sexual abuse and the abusers themselves. Before I go any further, let me share Dr. Burrows' website with you. I'm sure many of you will be eager to take a look at her illustrated books on courage and authenticity, which we discussed. So here's one. It's www.ninaburrows.com, and Burrows is spelled B-U-R-R-O-W-E-S. You'll find links to her blog there, as well as a video of a presentation she gave on courage and authenticity. And although it wasn't a TED.com video, it has that same kind of production values. I wasn't able to find a link to her research site from that page, however. It may be there, but I couldn't find it. If you're interested in seeing the report she wrote on rape and sexual abuse that I was referring to in our interview, you'll find that on her research site at www.nb-research.co.uk. And that middle part is NB, that's as in Nancy Bravo hyphen research.co.uk. I'm particularly impressed by her use of drawing as a tool for relaxation and personal development. I think the way that it has evolved as a way to illustrate compelling stories about the inner journey is particularly compelling. I think she's on an exciting voyage of discovery that will open many doors, not only for her readers, but also for her. And any of you out there who, A, may be victims of past sexual abuse or rape, I certainly think that you would want to check out these books that she's written. But also those therapists out there in our audience, I think you're going to want to have one or more copies in your library, not only to read yourself, but to give out to clients, loan out, let them buy them from you, whatever. So if you decide to buy paper or Kindle versions of her books, as always, you can order them using the Amazon widget in our right-hand sidebar.
Hi, Dr. Dave. It's Adam from Melbourne, Australia. I've been a long-time listener for over 7 years, and finally I think it's time to back up my appreciation of Shrink Wrap Radio with a donation. You provide such a wonderful, stimulating podcast, and you deserve to have this supported financially by your loyal listeners like me. And you're right, donating to Shrink Wrap Radio made me feel great, so I encourage other listeners to donate and keep supporting your unique podcast. Thanks, Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Adam, there in Melbourne. I really appreciate your encouraging others to follow in your footsteps by adding their support to Shrink Wrap Radio. Amazingly, it's been some time since we've had any new signups for ongoing donations. If you go to our honors page, you'll see maybe 40 or 50 names of those good souls who've made that commitment. However, that means there are literally thousands of you out there who are essentially getting a free ride on 9 years' worth of content, over 400 interviews, and probably more than 300 of those with transcripts. Won't you please do the right thing and join other supporting contributors at the level that you can afford and get your name up there on the honors page? As Adam said, you'll feel so good when you do. Now, speaking of transcripts, we do have an important new addition thanks to Nancy Wicker. It's the transcript for number 392 on Time, Trauma, and Heroism with Dr. Philip Zimbardo, a major figure in psychology. Thank you, Nancy. Also, don't forget about the International Association for the Study of Dreams Conference in Berkeley, California, running June 4th through the 8th of 2014. It's open to all, and I hope to see you there. Click on the link in the left-hand sidebar at shrinkwrapradio.com for full details and registration. And I have a upcoming interview with one of the keynote speakers for that conference, which will be coming up in a few weeks. I'll say more about that in the future when I'm sure that I've got that interview locked in. Finally, if you're new to Shrink Wrap Radio, you might not be aware that there is an app for that, which is to say we have an app for listening to the 75 most recent Shrink Wrap Radio episodes on your iOS or Android device. Just think, there in your pocket or purse, you can have most recent 75 shows for working in the garden, going on a walk, listening to in your car, or wherever. So just click on the apps tab at the top of the homepage on shrinkwrapradio.com for full details.
Hi, this is Fernando Blanco from Mexico City. You're on the couch, on a rock, on a boat, on a plane, with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Fernando Blanco. I love the fact that we have such an international audience. The last time I checked, we had listeners in something like 179 countries, although some of those countries only had one or two listeners. Hey, help spread the word, little countries in particular. Well, let's start off hearing from our listener community with an audio submission from naturopathic doctor and longtime listener and supporter, Dr. Ralph Wilson.
Hello, Dr. Dave. This is Dr. Ralph Wilson here in Washington, D.C. You're David, I'm Ralph, and we're part of this family that I feel exists across the planet, and you're part of helping us hear from each other. The people in Australia were very important for my survival. They kept my father safe. He was a warfighter in World War II, fought in aerial combat, and I'm so glad that they helped him. And the recent movie, The Railroad Man, was filmed partly in Australia, and I think it'd be a great thing for you to watch. One of the things in there is a reminder of the importance of communications. The Armed Forces Radio Network is one that you considered for a while working with, and I think that movie would show you how important that has been in the history of people wanting to make the world a safer place. So thank you from this veteran of military service, one who's enjoying watching the civilian world out there and making me feel that, yes, it was definitely worth it to put my life and my brains at risk, and thank you so much. Aloha, goodbye, good eye, mate.
Thank you, Dr. Ralph. I love it when people take the time to send me an audio like that. I think in part Dr. Ralph was paying tribute to Australia because, if I recall correctly, I myself had recently mentioned how appreciative I am of my many Australian listeners. Also, in an exchange of emails, Dr. Ralph has taken me to task a bit for my decision to stop posting episodes to the Armed Forces Network. I understand his passion for that service as a veteran and one whose dad served in World War II. I originally accepted the invitation to contribute episodes to that network because of its historical importance and because I thought I might be providing a message of hope to service people scattered around the globe. However, the Armed Services Radio Network just isn't what it was back in the day. It's essentially the work of two guys who are trying to revive it. Shrink Wrap Radio is not a good match for any of the other programming that they have. I think anybody who listens to the Armed Services Network these days also will have access to the internet, and thus to this show and the vast sea of content that is out there. So I don't think there is the same need out there that existed during the 1940s. Cutting episodes down to the length the new owners wanted was more work for me. And by the way, the current Armed Services Network doesn't have any ties to the U.S. government or armed services, as far as I know. Finally, I actually offered a cash bribe to the first listener on that network to contact me, and nobody did. So that pretty much told me that either nobody was listening or nobody who cared very much. So, Ralph, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it, for now at least. Continuing our international theme, I received the following email from Caroline in Zurich, Switzerland. And she writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, you may remember our Skype talk, the Swiss girl from Zurich? You were offering me to illustrate your podcast shows when I was asking how I could support you. Well, I'm not contacting you in regard to this, but want to thank you so much for your shows. I used to listen to your podcasts from my laptop while sitting on my desk. Not exaggerating, I treat your shows as a piece of cake or reward after a long day of work, or as a way better alternative to an evening at the movie theater in Zurich. A couple of weeks ago, I decided to make some changes in my life. For instance, surfing less on the internet, being more in nature, beginning to run, and tackle my goal of expanding my English vocabulary. Somehow, I got the idea to download your podcasts on my cell and listening to them on my daily strolls along Lake Zurich. So I would have you in nature and learning English. Actually, I've downloaded two of your shows so far and listen to them again and again. They're number 397 and number 308, where you are the interviewee. I greatly enjoy listening to you as a person. I think you share slash or communicate your thoughts in a very understandable and entertaining way. In addition, the shows are educational and inspiring. The show on synchronicity gave me the thrills pertaining to your experiences. I'm glad that came through. I combine this terrific gem you offer with your shows while improving my English vocabulary and learning in the area of my long-standing passion, psychology. This coming Christmas, one of my life dreams will come true. I will relocate to the Bay Area and study psychology to become a counselor. Hence, I want to improve my English language skills, particularly with words that are used in psychology. I really appreciate your English and would be thankful if I could speak nearly as well as you." She goes on to say, "Well, and the last thing, which may sound a bit wacky, listening to you provides me an emotional, warm feeling of being back in the Bay Area where my soul is home. Again, thank you so much. With warmest regards, Caroline." Caroline, thanks so much for that communication along with others that we've had more recently. And when you get out here, perhaps we'll be able to get together over a cup of coffee or hot chocolate, although neither will be as good as that could be obtained in Zurich, Switzerland. Finally, here's one more, this one from Justin, who writes, "Hi, I just recently discovered your podcast and have been cherry-picking a few past episodes, which had titles that interested me to listen to. I do this when I find a new podcast to see if I'll enjoy it enough to subscribe, and I'm really enjoying yours. I have a BA in psych with plans on getting my PhD. Haven't really decided on a specific area of interest yet. I'm also a blues musician, so I really enjoyed the interview that you did with Mark Winborn. I'm looking forward to reading his book. The real reason I'm contacting you is because yesterday I listened to the interview you did with Gabrielle Glasser, I can't remember how to pronounce her name, who has some strong opinions about AA. I have a cousin who is in Narcotics Anonymous, and my old guitar teacher is in AA. And from hearing them talk, I never liked what the programs were teaching. I wondered to myself, what if someone were to create a program that focused on empowerment and self-efficacy rather than tearing down the ego and being a helpless, hopeless junkie who could never recover? Not long ago, I heard an interview somewhere with Peter Soderman, who's written a book called Powerless No Longer, that takes this approach. He also has very strong feelings about the efficacy of AA and other similar programs. So anyway, if this is a topic that interests you, I thought he may be someone you would want to think about having as a guest. Loving the show. Thank you, Justin. Well, Justin, thank you for that. It's always wonderful to have a new listener discover the show. I'm wondering how you found it. I don't really always know how people find their way to Shrink Wrap Radio. And I hope that you do decide to subscribe to it and maybe even become a supporter. I will definitely add your suggestion of Peter Soderman to my long list of suggested guests. I did go look him up online and see his book. I see that at this point he's retired in Mexico. Still, it is a good topic, and it might be good to do yet another interview in that topic area. Also, Justin, as a blues musician, I would encourage you to consider maybe submitting some kind of a musical transition for the show. Maybe I'll contact you about that and see if I can recruit you. Okay, I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemail on our message phone at 206-337-7170. And you can leave voicemails using our iPhone/Android app, which I spoke about earlier. Thanks again to Dr. Nina Burrows, the cartooning psychologist, for sharing her unique career with us. My next guest will be computer scientist Dr. Jennifer Goldbeck, who I discovered on TED.com. She writes the programs for industry that allow them to penetrate our false sense of privacy via our activities on social media. There's a warning there, I think, and that's what I'm planning to explore with her. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.